Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, editor of Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our editor-in-chief, Lisa Henderson. For today's episode, we are speaking with Dr. Harsha Rajasimha, founder and chairman of Indo-US Rare.
In addition to his major role at Indo-US Rare, which was founded in 2019, Dr. Rajasimha is founder and CEO of Giva Informatics, and he also serves on the Rare Disease Clinical Trials Steering Committee of the Rare Disease Diversity Coalition and is a member of the Board of Directors for Greater Gift. Dr. Rajasimha has over 15 years of experience in healthcare and life sciences consulting, precision medicine, genomics of rare disease, and cancer. So we have read Harsha's LinkedIn and his founder's memo, which you can find on the Indo-US Rare website, which we encourage listeners to read at www.indousrare.org. So thank you for joining us today, Harsha.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Yes, thanks for joining us today. The first question I want to get into is about your background. Can you describe how your undergraduate degree in computer science and engineering led to the next steps into bioinformatics and further into genetics? And what interested you in taking that path?
Absolutely. It's very interesting. As I came out of the computer science engineering major in undergrad to grad school at Virginia Tech in computer science, that was in the year 2000, and the Human Genome Project had just completed, and there was so much media around it and excitement and hope to cure most genetic diseases and computation was to be a big part of that, as the human genome is a string of letters, as we know, ACGT, and it's to understand, decode, needed a lot of string algorithms, data analysis, database integrations, and that kind of work. So I thought it was a very good segue for me, and application that had some meaningful impact on human health. So that got me into specializing in the bioinformatics area. And there was a big initiative on campus at Virginia Tech in those years. A new building was coming up called the Virginia Bioinformatics Institute. And I got a graduate research assistantship there, and I got deeper and deeper involved in analysis of bacterial and viral genomes to begin with, eventually leading to human genome analysis at the National Eye Institute, where I went after finishing my PhD. So it's been an exciting journey, Andy, since then.
So as I mentioned in the intro, Harsha, there's a founder's memo on the Indo-US Rare website, which explains clearly and very emotionally why you founded the nonprofit. So could you briefly share that story with our audience?
Yeah, certainly. You know, as I was going about my postdoctoral career, analyzing genome sequencing data and interpretation and published numerous articles, I was loving every single day coming to work. And when I and my wife had a baby born with a rare congenital disease in 2012 with Edwards syndrome, I got more exposed to the pains that families go through. And the diagnostic odyssey in our case was short-lived, as we essentially got the diagnosis at birth, and the baby were to live only 4 days in the NICU. And that experience gave me a different perspective beyond what I was used to as a scientist. And I turned into a patient advocate soon after, and have been focused on helping other patients. As I learned, there are a lot of advances and resources available for the last 40 years. You know, this year marks the 40th anniversary of the Orphan Drug Act of 1983, which has revolutionized the development of medicines for rare diseases. Back then, we had only a handful of orphan drugs. And as of today, we have over 1,080 approved orphan drugs by the FDA. And so I founded Indo-US Organization for Rare Diseases when I realized that the majority of orphan drugs are discovered, developed in the Western world, and there is significant underrepresentation, awareness, education among the Indian diaspora in particular, but also number of other underrepresented minorities, you know, both racial and ethnic diversity, but also other kinds of, you know, gender, socioeconomic, and other types of barriers for all patients to meaningfully participate and engage and benefit from the Orphan Drug Act and the medicines that are coming out. They are not accessible to everyone equally yet.
So can you tell me how Indo-US Rare works then?
Essentially, we have, you know, I'll give you major programs. The key is helping individual patients with rare diseases with their care navigation. Irrespective of where they are located, they contact Indo-US Rare via online concierge or a form submission. And that gets us into the core team, which discusses the case as a group and put our heads together. And one, make connections to the patient based on the specific disease diagnosis status or geographic location. What is the best care options available? Next steps. And that comes with a lot of experience. And, you know, when a family is going through a regular routine and suddenly there is a child or someone in the family diagnosed with a rare disease, they have no idea what to do next, where to go, because the primary care physicians may not really have a good training in rare diseases, which we all know is true. And so they need a lot of help. And people who have already gone through that experience are way more well-versed with the resources and information. So we make connections with NIH GARD, with all the existing rare disease organizations which provide patient support, whether umbrella organizations such as Global Genes or NARD and Every Life Foundation, but also with disease-specific organizations that can help them navigate their own disease. And we also look into clinicaltrials.gov and see if there are any trials where the patient might be benefiting from looking into enrolling. So that's the first program, is the patient concierge service. The second is a patient foundation advocacy alliance, where we have a membership program for other disease-specific nonprofits who are based anywhere in the world, but have an interest in increasing awareness and engagement of the Indian diaspora with them. One of the reasons also, Lisa and Andy, that I founded Indo-US Rare is over the 10 years of patient advocacy and attending conferences, many patient advocates would come up to me and say, we have a patient registry, we have a patient organization, a majority of our patients are in the US, there's maybe just 30 or 50. India has such a huge population, and there's probably thousands of patients affected by rare diseases there. How do I get in touch with them? And that's the problem we are still working on solving in collaboration with these Patient Advocacy Alliance members, which is now at about 34 members and growing. And these member organizations represent over 500 rare diseases with over 25,000 individual patient members in their organization. So that's the second program. There, again, it's making cross-border collaborations, not just between patients and organizations, but also with medical geneticists, researchers, industry stakeholders who have a need or working on a rare disease. They have to collaborate with the patients and advocates. So we make those collaborations happen through focused on our member organizations. The third is a corporate alliance program, which is meant to bring the industry stakeholders to the table and engage with them and see how we can assist and accelerate their programs. You know, there is a lot of cell and gene therapy, clinical trials and research going on with much promise to cure certain genetic diseases if diagnosed and treated on time. And most of those are in the US and some in Europe, but there's not much going on anywhere else in the world. And that's something we really care about in terms of how we can help industry players think about global launch strategies, and including countries like India and other countries, as the patient population can be really much bigger in these other countries. And it's not always easy to identify all the patients with a particular disease in these other countries, just because the diagnostics and the processes are not as digitized. But all the technologies are available, like next generation sequencing and genomics and pretty much everything that we do in US and Europe are also available in several countries, including India. And so we encourage industry members to include prevalence and incidence of these rare diseases in their FDA submissions, and also help create the patient registries and natural history studies in these other countries, or make patients part of existing patient registries that are already ongoing in US. So they, if patients don't exist in the database, they just don't exist these days, because a lot of the research happens data-driven. And so we inform and educate the patients the importance of being included in registries and natural history studies. And it does take some effort on the patients and families to participate in these registry programs. But it's definitely a important step in the right direction. And so that's where we focus on. So those are the three major programs. And then we have year-long events like educational webinars. We spotlight on specific rare diseases and inform the community on the challenges and progress happening, bringing world's leading experts on those diseases to speak from, again, from different stakeholders, you know, industry, advocacy, research, and medicine. And we also collaborate with the most of the existing organizations, like, for example, Every Life Foundation on the Rare Disease Legislative Advocates, RDLA. During February, we go to the Congress and inform the Rare Disease Congressional Caucus, as well as the India Caucus, on the urgent need to foster US-India relationships around biotechnology, gene therapy, and rare disease. So those are some of the key programs, Andy and Lisa.
It definitely sounds like you have your hands full with all that, but it's great to hear all that and all the work you're doing. You know, since you founded the company, can you point to any major successes or proudest achievements that stick out to you?
Absolutely. We are really proud of the fact that India now has a national policy for rare diseases and has allocated a budget of 5 million Indian rupees towards the treatment of an individual patient with a rare disease in India. So that's a significant first step in the right direction. And we believe that that may not completely cover the cost of gene therapy priced at $1 million, but it does cover a significant proportion for certain types of treatment options, you know, and so potentially could make India a market for orphan drugs, not just for research and development, but also for commercialization, as there is some reimbursement from the government side, in addition to the patients paying out of pocket and other means. So we are educating the US biopharmaceutical industry to look at their global launch strategy and include India as part of their commercialization strategy very early on, you know, not as an afterthought, but if they can include India as one of their sites while they are conducting their clinical trials, or have the option for patients from India to travel to US sites, get the one and done treatment, and then go back and be monitored remotely. Those are all possible ways in which engagement can happen even during the early research and development of these orphan drugs. So that's one area where we are really proud of. And so far, we have also been contacted individual patients reaching out to us through referrals and word of mouth. And, you know, they come seeking assistance, and we are really proud that we are able to help patients get the best care option available. Or if there is no care option available, work towards collaborating and working towards a treatment and accelerating that pathway, starting from wherever they are at that point. They have a registry, natural history study, there are some publications and preclinical data. It's important for patient advocates to collaborate with industry and drive the development of therapy for that disease. And so we are proud that we are able to help patients get the best care option available anywhere in the world, as we continuously collect and collate information on different rare diseases and resources.
Thank you, Harsha. You mentioned this briefly in your last response, but could you elaborate a bit more on why the population of India is particularly important in the study and treatment of rare diseases?
Andy, we believe that all population, the entire human race, is equally important when it comes to genetics and human disease, because we are all in this together, and COVID-19 really shed the light on that, right? Like whether rare or common disease, we got to take care of each other. And so in that regard, all countries, religions, race, ethnicities, everybody is important. Now, Indian diaspora is particularly important for the simple fact that proportionally the population is like 1.4 billion and they are really immigrated all over the world. And so in United States, we have 4.2 million Indian Americans living. And the fact that clinical research continues to be 80% or more for all diseases combined, rare or common, mostly run on Caucasian population, just by nature of where clinical research is conducted in the US and Europe. But even here, Asian Americans, for example, are 50% less represented proportional to their population in the United States. And same for African American and Hispanic communities, it's even severe. A disproportional representation. So when it comes to Indian diaspora globally, you know, proportional to the Indian population, we are at like significantly underrepresented. And that's where we believe like the genomic databases, you know, as I was coming through my early research career, analyzing 1,000 genomes data, 100,000 genomes and the million genomes, you know, now the Precision Medicine Initiative or the All of Us research, they're all trying to get increased more diversity and recruit patients and engage them. And we are uncovering a lot of barriers and challenges. But it's really important to get, you know, India is considered the heaven for genetic researchers because of the various, the way arranged marriages are done and how paternal lineages have been preserved over 30, 40 generations in India. That makes India a very important partner and the population very critical to understanding human genetic diseases, which can affect anybody or in some cases disproportionately less or more. But definitely these purebred paternal lineages, or I shouldn't call purebred, but the paternal lineages that have been preserved are going to be really interesting. But also at a population scale, it's, you know, there are the ancestral North Indian genome is very different from the ancestral South Indian genome. And there is a lot of articles published, including in Nature Genetics and other places, which describe the genetic heterogeneity and the haplotypes and haplogroups that exist in these regions, which can shed a lot of interesting, already seen results of conducting research in that sense. So I would say those are some of the main reasons, but there are challenges to be overcome to effectively engage the Indian population in India. But we could certainly start with the Indian Americans here and also look at ways in which we can collaborate with scientists and researchers and patient groups that can contribute in this what we call global rare disease initiatives. And one last thing there, Andy and Lisa, is most of the rare disease organizations are nationally or regionally focused. That's very important to break that mold, just because rare diseases are cross-border. You know, we need to engage patients wherever they are, irrespective of their geographic location, and especially in rare and ultra-rare, where the number of patients with one single rare disease might be really small, but there's now over 10,867 rare diseases combined and with more than 350 million people globally. But if we keep working in silos in single countries, we are not going to get all the knowledge and science necessary to understand the disease natural history well enough. And that can affect the efficacy of our therapies and may disproportionately be benefit only a small subpopulation.
Thanks for sharing that, Harsha. There's a lot that you just said that could be teased out for about another hour, at least at the minimum. And so what specific ideas would you have for reaching an Indian American population for clinical trials?
Great question, Lisa. There's a couple of things I will mention. You know, one is the human aspects and other is the technology aspect. From a human aspect point of view, you know, engaging the physician investigators of Indian origin who often tend to treat more Indian patients as they are more familiar with the body types and physiology of Indian populations is very important because the patients often go to physicians who kind of look like them as there is a natural sense of trust and comfort, both in terms of culture, food habits, language, etc. And so when sponsors go about selecting clinical trial investigators and key opinion leaders, they got to also look at not just Indian, but various different diverse backgrounds proportional to the prevalence and incidence of that disease among different race and ethnicities. So that's something very critical for all sponsors to look at and include in their early planning exercise. You know, when FDA does ask for prevalence data, epidemiology data in their IND filings and so on, but usually they expect just the US one, but we encourage that we go beyond the US prevalence on a global scale. For example, sickle cell disease or hemophilia and many of these blood-related disorders disproportionately affect in the Middle East and India versus it's very rare in the US. And so knowing those prevalence and data points would be very important and include that in early planning and selecting investigators of the different diasporas. That's number one. The second, on the technology front, you know, most of the research platforms are developed for the English-speaking Western population over the last several decades. And so it's important to make sure technology does not become a barrier to engage underrepresented minorities in particular, who may not be as comfortable with English, but maybe still comfortable with technology, but not with English, and hence do not get to participate and engage. So making these platforms more multilingual, taking into account the dietary scheduling, you know, the religious holidays and other days of significance, which can be very many. For example, we have 10 national holidays in the US and 24 national holidays in India. As, India gives holiday for most religious days and not just the Hindu or the Christian, Muslim and several others, as well as other days of national significance. And so like it all makes a big difference when you go into a clinical trial as a patient and you know that you're taken care of and you're understood as to which days you might be able to come or not come, as opposed to scheduling based on a single country's or a single group's calendar. So that just as an example, but various technology aspects of engaging, not just inviting them to the research, but also including and retaining them throughout the study takes a lot more work, both at the human level and also at the technology level.
Those are all great points. Thank you so much. And I think they kind of answer the next question, which is how can a global approach to clinical trials accelerate medical solutions?
Did kind of answer that during our conversation,
yeah.
Which is rare diseases in particular, but all diseases are essentially global in nature. They are human in nature. They affect people. And so like taking these nationalistic and regional approaches is a significant barrier and hindrance. There is good reason why that is done, because of regulations and regulatory policies and frameworks that differ from country to country.
Mm-hmm.
But those have to be overcome. You know, we have had Belmont Report and Helsinki Declaration around clinical research, human subjects protection and ethics on a global scale, which every country adopts. So we need more of these global standards and global guidelines and regulations so that the country-specific barriers are decreased to the extent possible. But that's one part of it. But also getting these databases set up in a way that can engage data from different patients from different countries, and ability to share the data governance part of it and data sharing, considering the GDPR, HIPAA, and various regional data protection policy and guidelines, that's still an unsolved problem to a large extent. Unless it's part of a single clinical trial, then even there, we see, like, depending on whether the trial is global or, you know, which countries, they may want physical location of the data in that country's jurisdiction and stuff like that. So there is a lot of challenges to overcome, but that has to be done if we have to make clinical research and trials more efficient and faster, because we hear US sponsors are 85% of the clinical trials are delayed due to patient recruitment, and 30% of clinical trials terminate because of poor enrollment. When there are patients sitting on the edge outside of US somewhere and staring in without being engaged and invited, but that will help. That'll be a win-win, you know, for both the sponsors as well as patients, and ultimately that's what we are all here for.
Now, this is another question that maybe you touched on a bit, mentioning, you know, more uniform rules and regulations across the globe when it comes to clinical research and other medical services. Would you say that's the most important next step in bridging that gap, or is there something else that comes to mind?
It definitely is one of them, and that's certainly above most people's pay grade, and you know, that requires a bit more political and will and collaboration at a much grander scale. And organizations like bio and pharma, and like the you know, the Senate, Congress, and the country level discussions have to occur at, and NIH and FDA could potentially take a lead in those areas. But beyond that, at the industry level, at the patient level, you know, much more education and awareness around why we need to do certain things like patient registries or natural history studies. You know, many times a mother asks me, can you help get treatment to my child? That's what really I care about. When I request them to consider participating in this patient registry and natural history study, they don't immediately see the value, because how is it going to help? You're adding more work on my plate. I got to spend a few minutes every day or every week entering data into this patient registry. And I don't see how it will help improve my daughter's condition or my son's condition. And that's where we are educating and informing them, like, get in the line. If you are not part of the registry and natural history study, when a clinical trial comes up for a gene therapy or any other treatment option, they are going to recruit patients whose baseline data is already known in these databases. And so it's very important to get in the queue. And it has happened many, many times as an example for Tay-Sachs disease, but also for other diseases where patients have been participating in this registry and natural history for 5-10 years. And when a gene therapy has been in the works recently for Tay-Sachs disease, obviously the patients who have been part of those registry studies have to be given a priority. You know, we can't have a new patient come in and get the treatment during a clinical trial. One, we lack the baseline data of how the patient was behaving or progressing before the treatment, which is very important in rare disease because we don't have a large control population. And all the participants in a rare disease trial are likely to be patients suffering from the disease, and there are no placebos and controls. And so it's important that to inform and educate. I would say that's the biggest urgent need that we can actually take action on, while also advocating at the government levels to work on the global standards. We call patients and families with rare disease as warriors. You know, we have to push all the stakeholders to work diligently in the best interest of patients in pushing towards faster treatment options for specific rare diseases, but also generically, what are the commonalities that can be addressed, which will help all 10,000 plus rare diseases, as we can't duplicate the effort on one disease at a time. So there is a good bit of effort happening at the umbrella level, but also at specific disease level. And we are really honored to collaborate with all the stakeholders at both these levels in advancing and accelerating the therapies. So I invite everyone to look at indousrare.org and contact us and see how we can be a partner and a collaborator in this journey.
Thank you, Harsha. Thank you so much for sharing your story. This was extremely insightful. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much, Harsha.
Thank you for the opportunity, and really enjoyed speaking with both of you today, and hopefully it'll get some engagement and interest from the audience as well.